to the sixth case, United States versus DeMonica. Mr. Eisenberg?
May it please the Court, I'm Mark Eisenberg. I represent Nick DeMonica in this case. This case is a perfect example of why the United States Supreme Court modified Matlock in Georgia versus Randolph. As you know, in Georgia versus Randolph, a physically present co-occupant may object to another's consent to search, and that objection prevails over the consent of the co-tenant, and it renders the warrantless search unreasonable. The Georgia facts are almost very similar to the facts in our case. There, the parties were separating. The wife returned home. There was a domestic argument. She calls the police. She says he uses cocaine. He comes back during the middle of that. He denies the cocaine use. She says there's items of paraphernalia and drugs in the house. The police officer asks for him for permission to search. He says no. They ask the wife. She consents. They go in and they find paraphernalia, and some residue. They ask for further consent. She withdraws it. They go get a warrant. That's a lot different than what happens in our case. And they distinguish Matlock. Matlock controls only when the objecting party is absent, so he can't object. And they say that the person living with another assumes no greater risk of control to the house except when they're absent. Facts in our case are almost identical. Parties are going through bad times. The wife calls the police. She says there's some domestic issues that happened 2 weeks before the incident, before she reports it. And she says, oh, by the way, there's guns and drugs in the house. And the police devise a plan at that time. And if you look at the motion, there is a report that was attached to the motion to suppress from William Hendrickson, a Dane County Narcotics Gang Force task officer. And he says that I assisted DCI in the logistics pertaining to planning the search and arranging for the arrest of Nicholas DeMonica on domestic charges, and then in the facilitation of the search and assisting in the documentation and counting of currency seized in the process. So they had the plan, they wanted to remove him, and they wanted to search. Now, the wife keeps going. She says, well, here's the keys to the house. You have my consent to enter, but she gives a caveat with that. He's not going to let you in. The police arrive. They know he's not going to let them in. So they devise this ruse to get into the house. Your wife's been in a bad car accident. At that time, he says, wait right there. I'm going to go put a shirt on. Now, the police officer's testimony differs significantly at that time. They say he let him in. And I ask you, and I ask 100 police officers to come in here and tell me that's how a police officer would operate. I have concerns that there are drugs and guns in the house. I get into the house. Oh, excuse me, officer, I need to go put a shirt on. Can I go back into the main house, and while I'm there, I'll get the gun and come back and shoot you? Or in the alternative, I'll get the drugs and flush them down the toilet. No police officer would let him do that. And that's not what happened. These people had 5 to 6 hours to get a search warrant, and they decided not to do that. And this fact differs from Randolph. Now, I can hear the government now. Two issues for you to decide. He consented to the entry, or her consent was sufficient to let them in, and he never refused. He never refused the search. Well, as I said earlier, he never consented.
Well, why does this matter? The majority in Randolph says it is drawing a hair-splitting distinction. Mm-hmm. But there it is. The language of Randolph says that if the person is removed from the premises and prevented from consenting or rejecting, then the search is fine.
No.
That's the exact language of Randolph. I can read it to you verbatim.
Actually, Your Honor, I thought it said that you cannot remove a potentially objecting occupant so he can't object. And that's exactly what they did here, and that's exactly what the plan was, because Anita told him them he would object. I believe that's in there as well, and I don't have it right in front of me. I have it over there, but I'll look for it, saving my rebuttal time, and see if I can find that for you. So, one, I don't think he ever consented. And, two, I don't think I think you can infer that he would have refused. You can infer that because she told them.
Yeah, but that's exactly the problem. The court says we are maintaining Matlock, and we understand Matlock to be the case of the person removed from the house, seated in a squad car. They don't either ask for his consent or listen, and they search on the basis of somebody else's consent.
But
and the court says, we're reiterating the holding of Matlock, and that's a hair-splitting distinction with Randolph, but there it is.
My argument to that, Your Honor, is that in those cases the person was legally arrested, and here it wasn't. But I think the language in Randolph...
The arrest was perfectly legal here. It was based on probable cause. That's all you ever need for an arrest.
Not inside someone's home.
No.
Unless there's exigent circumstances.
There are separate questions. One is whether the arrest is lawful. The other is whether any search in connection with the arrest was lawful.
To me, Your Honor, illegally entering the house to effectuate arrest without a warrant doesn't matter whether you have probable cause or not. You cannot go into someone's...
Sorry, you're wrong.
I guess that's an issue that we'll have to discuss later. I was going to suggest that I believe you can infer circumstantially, and sometimes circumstantial evidence is better than direct evidence, that Mr. DeModica would not have consented to this. Anita told them that he would
no
refuse.
No doubt in the world that Mr. Matlock would not have consented either. But he was put in a squad car and not asked.
But he was already...
That's just what happened to your client.
But my client was arrested in his home without a warrant when police officers gained illegal entry into the house. I see that as a significant difference than had he been outside and sitting in his front yard, and the police officers came up and arrested him in his front yard. Because that was the whole plan. Let's get him out of the house so we can arrest him. Because otherwise they had the keys, Your Honor. Why didn't they just open the door and walk in the house? Because they knew they couldn't do it because they knew her consent wasn't any good. That's an illegal arrest. That's what the warrant requirement is all about, to have, to, especially in the house. Our home is the Fourth Amendment was designed to protect. That's the stronghold of this of that amendment. I was also going to talk about Anita's consent wasn't sufficient. I think I've talked about that already. These police officers lied. There is no doubt in my mind, and I use that language strongly here, and I don't use that regularly, but there is no way that police officers in a house would let a dangerous, who they presume, person to go back into that house, get a shirt, and you can tell they lied because as soon as he came back in that house, they jacked him up against the wall, or one of them did, jacked him up against the wall and arrested him.
So we've got to replace Judge Crabb's credibility assessment. Is that what you're asking, Mr. Edmund?
Actually, Your Honor, I think Judge Crabb felt that way too, because if you look at her decision, she says the magistrate felt that way. But then she said, even if the magistrate...
I meant the magistrate.
I think the magistrate says it's cloudy what happened, and he doesn't really know for sure. I believe that's in his language. And then Judge Crabb says, well, even if the magistrate was wrong in that credibility assessment, I find it doesn't matter because Matlock controls. I would like to save a minute for rebuttal because I want to find that passage, so I will be back. Thank you.
Thank you, Justin. Ms. Przybylinski?
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is Laura Shevelinsky Finn. I'm an assistant United States attorney in Madison, Wisconsin. I was counsel at the district court level in this case and obviously remain here today. I agree with Judge Easterbrook that Randolph is a hair-splitting decision, sometimes painfully so in going through the facts of these cases.
It's not my proposition. It's the majority's own proposition.
It is, Your Honor.
What they say is, I think... We have to admit that we are drawing a fine line, indeed.
It is, and that is the fine line we're walking. But if Matlock remains intact at all and means anything, it means this. It means this case. This case almost mirrors Matlock, and Judge Crabb notices that. She said, well, there are some differences. They are immaterial. And I think if we back up a little bit, I know that Mr. Eisenberg's main argument is that the police officers were liars in this case. The first thing I would say is, in the end, whether or not they illegally entered Mr. DeMatica's home to arrest him and violated Peyton is not relevant to the final question here. That said, the magistrate judge found that these officers did have Mr. DeMatica's permission to enter his home. He didn't do that loosely. He didn't do that in a way that he wasn't quite sure. He said, these findings might not matter, but I am making them. And Judge Crabb adopted those findings. What Mr. Eisenberg suggests for a remand is to send it back to see if they still make those findings. These are factual findings. This is a magistrate judge who takes very seriously his job, and he found that the officers were credible. That said, even if the officers didn't have consent, it's a separate issue whether or not they entered illegally or whether or not they arrested Mr. DeMatica with probable cause. If he's arrested with probable cause, then he is properly in custody. If he's properly in custody and removed from the scene, Anita DeMatica's consent is just fine under Randolph, and the search is also just fine. So that's where the focus really is. It's a distinction that this court recognized in Blackwell. It's a distinction that the Supreme Court looked at in Harris, distinguishing that case from Brown. Basically, the custodial setting, a defendant doesn't get to say, you know what, you screwed up on the entry, and even though you had probable cause to arrest me, I get to go home now. That's just not how it works. And so here, regardless of how the police got Mr. DeMatica, he was arrested based on probable cause, he is appropriately removed from the scene, and like Matlock, he does not get the opportunity to refuse consent or not. That really is all there is to it. And unless the court has any further questions, I have nothing further.
Thank you.
I did argue the probable cause issue in my brief, but Judge Easterbrook, what I found here, after they talk about the hair splitting, the language specifically says, this is the line we draw, and we think the formalism is justified. So long as there is no evidence that the police have removed the potentially objecting tenant from the entrance for the sake of avoiding a possible objection, there is practical value in the simple clarity of the complementary rules. That's what they did.
Yes, but their rule doesn't depend on subjective intent. As you know, they've been very clear that Fourth Amendment lines are wholly objective, not subjective.
Well, I think they say this right
here.
They're
not overruling Wren or Scott or those other cases. Indeed, they go out of their way to enforce them.
But the language here, Your Honor, says something different.
So you're asking us to say that sub silentio they overruled Wren and Scott.
I'm saying that the language in here says that when you remove somebody so they cannot object, and that was their plan, they can't do that. By the way, my father was the one who argued Matlock in the Supreme Court, by the way. I want to get that into it.
All right. Thanks to both counsel. Mr. Eisenberg, thank you for accepting the appointment in this case. Case is taken under advisement, and the court will stand in recess.